choke points.
Let's go.
Distracted driving, excessive speed, other bad driver behaviors continue to kill and injure people on the roads, and the risks in work zones are particularly severe. Here's Chris.
Yeah, Dave, check out these numbers. There were 1,228 crashes in work zones or their related backups in Washington last year. 1,228. 28 of them resulted in serious injuries. 10 of them included fatalities. The risk to those working along our roads is great. The Washington Department of Transportation head Roger Millar says this has got to stop.
The number of work zone fatal crashes in 2023 doubled compared to 2022. This is simply not acceptable.
Following too closely, excessive speed, distraction, and impairment are the most likely causes for slamming into a work zone. There have already been two work zone crashes this year where impairment is suspected. In January, six WashDOT workers doing overnight pothole repair were injured when a suspected drunk driver plowed into their trucks near Vancouver. WashDOT Southwest Regional Manager Carly Francis.
Please slow down in work zones. Remain alert. Put the phone down and never, ever drive under the influence.
DUI was a factor in seven of those 10 fatal work zone crashes in Washington last year. While not in a work zone, State Trooper Christopher Gadd was killed by a suspected drunk driver going well over 100 miles an hour in Everett earlier this year. State Patrol Chief John Batiste is begging drivers to change their ways.
You know, when we're behind the wheels of our cars and our trucks, it's all about decision making and choices that we make. It's a choice and a poor decision to drive under the influence. It's a choice and a decision to speed, in particular through work zones.
WashDOT is actually changing its procedures this year to try to cut down on the number of work zone accidents. Changes include bundling more jobs together to reduce the amount of time that workers are exposed to traffic and moving more jobs to daylight hours. Millar says it's really just about making sure every worker gets home safely every day.
If it's not safe to do it at night, you do the work during the day. If it's not safe to do work on the shoulder without taking the lane, take the lane and keep people away from your crew. If it's not safe to work in the lane, close the highway and keep our workers safe. It's an inconvenience to the public, but at the end of the shift, everybody goes home.
The state is also expected to roll out new camera enforcement in work zones now that the legislature has approved that. This is National Work Zone Awareness Month, Distracted Driving Month. Great reminders for all of us drivers. Those workers are out there for us, making sure that our roads are safe to drive. The least we can do is make sure that they're safe while doing it.
Boy, if you had statistics, anything like this involving like air travel or public transit, we'd shut it down.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's driver behavior, individual choices, and things like that. And again, they're vulnerable too, because I mean, you've been in work zones. I've been in work zones in my years as a reporter. I mean, the traffic whizzing by at 70, 75 miles an hour, 5 feet from, I mean, imagine if we had to work under those conditions, if your office was that, and they're concentrating on doing their work, not watching their back for traffic. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of construction workers who say they've, for as many as these crashes are, there are probably double or triple amount of near misses where they've had to dive out of the way of someone who, you know, wasn't paying attention, ended up in a work zone.
But so, there's no enforcement, right?
That is correct. Well,
I mean, it's like
it takes a crash and then an investigation that potentially leads to a DUI that leads to something.
It's like the whole drug problem. We found out, we've now learned in two states now, when there's no enforcement, people go crazy. And maybe it's time to actually put police in a position to actually arrest people who go by work zones too fast, even before there's a crash.
Yeah, and I guess
somebody like loses a car, right? If we confiscate your car because you can't drive well, maybe, and that was publicized, people might think twice.
Yeah, impounding vehicles would be a very important tool. But you're right, it's got to start with enforcement. We don't have a lot because we don't have a lot of troopers. And those that we do have during the mornings or afternoons, or most of the time, they're out helping other motorists they're doing stops. Yeah. But I think it will take enforcement like this. We'll see how those automated traffic cameras go to see if that adds as a deterrent. But as we've seen in other places, that doesn't necessarily stop people from speeding through school zones or hospital zones or wherever those cameras are active. So it's just a sober reminder. I mean, more than 1,200 crashes into work zones just last year.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, that's way too many.
Let's get a Gaza update. I called up CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland and I wanted to ask him about the attack that happened this week on the World Central Kitchen. The question remains, was it a targeted attack or an accident? And Jeff is not persuaded that this was accidental.
Consider the fact that
the Israelis conducted a very precise mission at about the same time in Syria, in Damascus, Syria, where they hit a building associated with the Iranian embassy. It was described at one time as sending 7 missiles through a window to get one particular individual who was a general officer in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the Quds Force. And so they had a level of precise intelligence, timing, location, and weapon delivery that was really pretty admirable. At the same time, they managed to strike these 3 vehicles 1.5 miles apart, all of which were clearly marked as World Central Kitchen. Number 3, this particular aid group, as they want to do when they're operating in a combat zone, coordinate with the military authorities to make sure they know where they're at. This is called deconfliction. And so it seems to be a little bit incontrovertible to believe that both these things could be done, and one was just a terrible accident, and that one was a matter of precision.
Now, we're hearing in reports today that Israel has been using AI to essentially automatically choose targets. Could this be a case where the machine said, oh, these people look like terrorists, go or no go, and somebody just says, oh, heck, the machine's probably right?
Well, that's certainly possible, and there's no two ways about it. I mean, I have had my own personal experience in a couple cases. One, I was once machine gunned by a Cobra gunship during the Gulf War who thought I was an Iraqi, so I have some personal experience with mistakes being made in combat. And I was also working on the NSC staff during the Kosovo crisis when I received a sudden message that we, the United States, had inadvertently bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in the middle of that conflict. So major screw-ups that do occur in war, no two ways about it. Artificial intelligence, as dramatic as it is, does offer up that particular problem you described, and that is taking the human being totally out of the loop and making this sort of automatic, leaving it up to the machine, and consequently accidents like this might well have occurred.
CBS's Jeff McCausland. This week, the New York Times published a story headlined Shortcuts Everywhere, How Boeing Favored Speed Over Quality, and it discloses a number of red flags, including some in-flight issues that didn't get wide coverage, but which in hindsight should have provided a warning that rules were being ignored. New York Times reporter Niraj Chokshi was one of the co-authors.
You know, we included these incidents because we thought that they really highlighted the ways in which, any sort of quality lapses or potential quality lapses are being viewed in a new light after the January 5th flight on Alaska Airlines, the one with the door plug that flew out. We were really trying to kind of highlight how these sorts of things, kind of speak to and for a lot of current and former employees, remind them of, these issues that they've tried to raise both internally and externally.
We've certainly heard the stories about employees whose warnings went ignored. Have you delved more into that? I saw at the end of the story, you were openly soliciting Boeing employees to report anonymously on what they've encountered on the line. So have you heard from them?
Yeah, we've heard from probably a few dozen current employees and many more former employees. We always welcome more voices. One thing that's always hard in these situations is you tend to hear from people who have complaints or maybe an axe to grind, and we want those. But it's helpful to hear from people who want to share positive stories or want to tell us how things were fixed or were addressed as well. There's clearly. One thing that's clear from all of the conversations that we've had with current and former employees is that there's a deep respect and love for the company and a real desire to see it move past these problems and to really succeed.
Well, I mean, absolutely. In the 46 years I've lived here, there's tremendous pride in Boeing, this being the home of Boeing, which is why it was considered a betrayal when they moved the corporate headquarters to Chicago and then moved the Dreamliner production to South Carolina. And I think it's been tough to recover from what, again, we, I think was considered almost an abandonment by the company here. So what is the current status of safety at Boeing? I mean, I know they've got to do something, but you can't just snap your fingers and change something that it sounds like has been building for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. I think, first on the safety point, I should say, I think it's worth holding in mind that, we are in the safest period in aviation history in the U.S. There hasn't really been a major crash in 15 years. That's not to excuse concerns. I think the January 5th flight raised a lot of valid questions about the quality of the planes Boeing puts out. The company has said, you know, they've added inspections, they're adding inspectors, they're trying to change the culture. But to your point, you know, it's difficult, right? I mean, and especially it's especially difficult with all these leadership changes that have gone on. You have new leaders. There, you know, Dave Calhoun, the CEO, is going to be leaving by the end of the year. And I think that, you know, to really change culture, you need a leader with a long-term vision. And that's going to be difficult until you have one in place.
We're hearing from New York Times reporter Niraj Chokshi, who co-authored the recent article, Shortcuts Everywhere, How Boeing Favored Speed Over Quality. And in the story, Niraj recounts how several Boeing employees reported pressure to take shortcuts in the manufacturing process, including not properly inspecting parts before installation.
There was real or perceived sense of pressure from management to kind of keep things moving. And, you know, I think people, you know, you see this in lots of places, right? People, you know, might excuse it saying, look, like we never find any problems with these parts. You know, it's we've done this 100 times. There's been no issues. You know, why do we need to check every single one? I think there's sorts of easy ways for people to kind of excuse that behavior to kind of keep things moving along.
Well, do employees have the power to stop the line if they see something wrong?
They do. And, you know, we've spoken to a lot of folks involved in quality who, you know, have described successful interventions when they find these sorts of things. But, you know, they also say that a lot of times, you know, they're sort of encouraged to either kind of let it go or, you know, to sort of tolerate maybe a corrective action that maybe doesn't suffice. A lot of them have described, yeah, people are sort of slapped on the wrist when these kinds of things happen, but, you know, everyone just kind of moves on pretty quickly, which sends a signal, right, that it's not that big a deal to skirt these kinds of procedures.
Any indications that at the management level that there were people in management who were noticing problems early on because of the attempt to speed up production? For years, we've heard about the consequences of the McDonnell Douglas merger, the reason they moved the headquarters away from to Chicago, away from here, to get away from reliance on these engineers who were sticklers for detail and didn't really care much about the financing. I just want to know if there is a trail of evidence indicating that management knew that some of these moves in the direction of making the company more profitable were sacrificing safety, which, as we have learned again and again, kills profits when you don't follow your procedures.
Yeah, you know, I will say that from the folks we've spoken to, there's a sense that management perhaps wasn't as connected to the schedule that they were putting out. It's not clear what they did or didn't know, but that there was sort of a sense that they didn't really understand, you know, what it was going to take to meet the production schedule that they wanted at times. And I think that sort of creates these incentives. Now, you know, management has also said that, you know, I mean, Dave Calhoun recently said that maybe the problem here was that we weren't clear enough that, you know, we do take quality seriously and that there was sort of something was lost in translation. But for sure, there was a sense from the folks who work there that, you know, I suppose backs that up as well.
So what has to happen now? I know that Boeing would like to come out with a brand new airplane that's a big hit with the airlines, but it sounds like they're going to be preoccupied with dealing with safety problems for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the most immediate priority is getting the house in order, is you know, really focusing on quality, making sure employees are clear that, you know, they can speak up and they will be heard when there are quality issues. And you know, proving to the public and proving to lawmakers and regulators that the company is actually, you know, walking the walk. And so that's priority number one. And I think from that, everything else will flow. Once they can do that, they can start to ramp up again. They can start to compete more aggressively with Airbus and you know, hopefully a few years from now be in a better competitive position.
Well, I know we all hope so. Niraj Chokshi is a reporter with the New York Times, latest Boeing story. And again, he's provided some convenient boxes where if you work for Boeing and you know what needs to be done next, you can supply that information anonymously to the New York Times. Niraj, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And Now time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A group of guys in California are offering to clean up people's swimming pools for free because they get paid for it in another way, a unique one. Here's CBS's Carter Evans.
An empty swimming pool in Southern California is about as close as it gets to a personal skate park. But before these guys grind, they clean the grime.
So you actually come in and do the work?
Yes.
At your age?
Yeah. A lot of times we'll do it for free, too.
Steve Alba is known as the godfather of pool skating. Now, 61 years old, he'll still clean your pool for free if you let him bring his board and his buddies. Fellow senior skater Ozzy Osbourne scans satellite images for squalid swimming pools, then does a door knock.
They oftentimes don't quite understand. You want to do what in the pool?
And to be honest with you, it started as kind of a joke. To be honest with you, to see if it would actually work.
And it did.
And it did work.
Decades later, they've perfected their pitch, which includes signing a liability waiver.
Oh, Marlin.
And many homeowners are thrilled to get rid of the eyesore.
What was your pool like?
A third filled with a bunch of green slop because it was a duck pond.
But the skaters saw something different.
What makes a good pool?
Yeah.
The shape of the pool is one criteria. The surface of the pool, the plaster, the best cool pools to skateboard in are the pools that were made from 1950 to, say, 1977.
Yeah.
That 27-year window is just prime for us.
What's up here?
This is a filter box,
which we call the death box, because if you actually go into it on the way down, you die. So you don't want to fall on that. So that's okay. Why we call it the death box.
The death box is daunting.
Just try to stay low and keep your knees bent and keep on your toes.
But let's be real. I was never gonna come close.
This is harder than it looks.
It's way harder.
Every pool is different. Every wall is different. It's like this little puzzle that I have to figure out. It's like this Zen thing where I'm doing anything, I'm thinking about skateboarding, but when I'm skateboarding, I can't think of anything else. It's a very seductive place to be.
What we do here is one of the best things, in my opinion, you can do in skateboarding. And if you got any more empty pools for us to skate, please send them our way.
Know.
For them, an empty pool is full of possibilities.
I loved the gnarly.
Yeah. Swimming pool sounds like a great idea until you start having to maintain it.
Isn't that it's like boats, it's like pools, family. Anything that seems fun, yeah.
Joining us now, G. Scott from the G. and Ursula Show, and only seven games in, and already it's what went wrong with the Mariners.
Man.
What went wrong with the Mariners?
Man, you know... I don't know. Again, I love to talk about things that date myself, and I want to maybe I can relate to somebody. Has anybody remembered the times of the days that your auntie or your grandmama or your mama said, baby, go out there and get me a switch?
What was that?
Go get me a switch.
Now you're probably
too young for that, David Burbank. Go get me a switch.
I remember, well, my parents never did it, but belt was the term. But
okay.
The switch or the belt, that was the same thing.
Right.
Yikes.
That's back in the day when kids had discipline.
No, we don't hit kids anymore.
I'm not saying you hit kids anymore. I'm just saying we had more discipline back in the day.
My dad's thing was, go wait in my room. I'll see you in a few minutes.
Yeah, that's not discipline. That's abuse. But
okay, well, that's what the Guardians told the Mariners yesterday. They said, go get my switch. And it was 8-0. Good Lord.
I heard there was an actual collision in the infield.
No, there actually was. Yeah, it was crazy. So I've been on this Mariner thing, and I've been going to watch the Mariners. And
you're wearing your Mariners jacket.
You see me?
That's slick, by the
you
way.
See,
all
you see
black.
And you see the all Mariners hat?
Yeah, you're really.
I'm really bought in to what the Mariners are doing. And it's been rough. And here's why it's rough. I, as you all know, I'm a football fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm used to football. Everything I do in my life, my family, football. And so when I go to a football game on a Sunday, and let's just say it's either, oh, it's a rough game. You watch the Seahawks, and oh, I was as a nail biter, my blood pressure, right? We don't have to do that again until next Sunday. You see what I'm saying?
You get a break from the heartbreak.
Yeah. When it happens every day, you're saying it wears on you.
I can't do this. I need to take garlic for my blood pressure. I cannot do this. I mean, you start talking. I mean, it gets to the point, and then people say, all of the baseball fans. And this is where maybe, David, you can help me out with. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's just baseball. It's just seven games. Don't you worry. These games really don't matter. What? Mm-hmm. What do you mean they don't matter? Mm-hmm. Who plays a game that don't matter? It's like being married and being like, my wife don't matter.
Well, maybe on a particular day.
162 games. You know, that is a lot of games. Seven games in the grand scheme doesn't mean a lot. But this is the issue is, at a certain point, you're going to want some of those losses back. When you're getting towards October and you're hoping, okay, we can make a run for the postseason. We're just a game out of the wild card. We're a couple games out of the wild card. You're going to want those games back that you had in April and May, where you could have potentially won. You could have done things to get yourself towards a win, and you didn't. And I think that's where a lot of the frustration comes in with me and fellow Mariners fans is, it's not different problems. It's the same problems we keep seeing season on. They keep saying, we're going to fix the strikeouts. This is a team that strikes out a lot, or historically has in the last several years. They are one of the top strikeout teams seven games into the season
this
season.
We are number one. Should we shorten the season?
Yes.
Is 162
yes.
too much? Why
yes.
do we play 162 games? Why do we play the same teams two and three times? It should be like football.
The same answer that baseball always has. What? Because tradition.
Yeah.
Because that's
money.
The way baseball
it's time to
is.
Money.
You okay?
Sorry.
If it's about money, then
why
wouldn't every sport expand then if it was about money? Mm. 162 games compared to how many do the NFL teams play?
Yeah.
How many do they play in a season?
Oh, 17.
17?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Can't you cut it in half and call it good?
In theory, baseball has less wear and tear on an athlete's body, so you can make it more.
I'm worried about G's heart. He can't take this anymore.
And if you, speaking of heart, I want to talk about not just my heart. I want to talk about collectively, mm-hmm. all the Mariners fans' hearts. Because this is what it reminds me of. It reminds me of living in the nice house. T-Mobile Park, nice house.
Nice house.
Nice furniture.
Yeah.
Everything's in there, right? You have this loyal person that's the fans going all the time.
Yeah.
And then every single time, the spouse just doesn't come home at night. They just don't. We got this nice house. We mm-hmm. have this nice relationship. I'm wanting to love you, but you keep doing the same thing over and over, Dave. You just don't come home at night.
That's why they got all those world-class restaurants there. That's just a big restaurant where baseball happens to be going.
Oh,
on.
Yeah.
I've seen that before, too. I've actually seen relationships where they're like, hey, why don't you just go buy yourself something nice? And then it kind of gets in the way of, you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. And us fans, every season, it's the same thing. We say, we're not going to buy in this season. We're finished with the Mariners. They're not doing enough to please us fans. We're going to the ballpark. We're paying all this money. We're paying for Root Sports, mm-hmm. all that. And yet, come March or come February, every season when spring training comes around, it's, all right.
See,
all right, I'm ready for the Mariners again. I'm ready to be hurt again.
I'm the new one in the relationship where mm-hmm. everybody's like, you don't want to date them. I'm trying to tell you. Don't do it. I know that person.
But
I'm like, I'm not
pretty.
Listening.
They're tempting. Aren't they? Yeah, you'll learn your lesson.
All right. Hey, shortest baseball honeymoon ever. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.